I got good news.
That's noise. What's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
You want to run the story? You got 5 hours until 8 o'clock. Go get the story.
We're after circulation. What we need is fireworks. People have been hit with sledgehammers. Start arguments.
Oh, I can do that. I know this town inside out.
You know who knows this town inside out? Robert Mack, reporter, political analyst, former host of Upfront on King TV. He's the principal at SeattleTopStory.com. Good to have you in the room, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Also, you know who knows this story, this town inside and out? Eli Sanders, Pulitzer Prize winner, associate editor at The Stranger. Sir?
Sir, nice to be here.
And you know who else knows? I can just keep doing this. Knut Berger writes the Mossback column at Crosscut.com. Blogs at Seattle Magazine, author of Pugetopolis. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Steve.
It's really going to be a whole discussion about the Seahawks, but everything's going to be couched in political terms. I just want you to know that today. and we're starting in Olympia because it's a long commute for those Olympia fans to get up to, you know, the stadium when they do come. The Republican Party said they supported the idea of a DREAM Act so that illegal immigrants will be able to go to college and succeed in this state. I believe I heard that phrase used. Robert Mack, is this big news?
I think it is big news. I would start with the political context of it, which is you've had a lot of Democrats in the state house who have been making accusations that the majority coalition, the Republican-led coalition in the Senate, has been extremely partisan this year. And I think this does something to address that and diffuse that. And I think the Republicans are in a big way here saying, listen, this is something that the Democrats in the House have wanted, that the governor has put out there, and this is something that they're willing to do.
What do you think?
Well, just to clarify, I think my understanding of it is that it's not illegal immigrants, it's the children.
Excuse me.
Legal immigrants.
Thank you.
So people who are brought to this country by people coming to this country illegally to seek work. Their children would have an opportunity to go to college with state assistance. And it seems like one of the reasons for the change of heart in the Republican-controlled Senate is that a number of the Republicans who have come around and started pushing this are in districts where this was very popular. And if they torpedoed it again, they would have a problem when they were running for re-election.
Well, they could have torpedoed it anyways if they'd wanted to. They could have, you know, avoided it. Why did they decide to embrace it? That's what I'm curious about. They went for it. They said, we're going to do this.
Well, that I don't know the answer for sure, but that is my theory, that we're coming up on an election year. And there wasn't as much of a consequence last year to torpedoing it. But if they did this year, then this is something that Democrats in their district were going to run on and use against them.
You agree with that? They were sort of running scared from the Democrats?
I agree that there's a political calculation. And I believe that Republicans in this state have figured out that they cannot be on the wrong side, particularly of the immigrant vote, of the Latino vote. Especially in some of the districts that where there's a large and significant and growing Latino population. So I do think there's a political calculation. Rodney Tom, who is in charge of the so-called majority coalition, is a big supporter of this legislation. And he took a hit this week because there were accusations that the Republicans were essentially taking over the coalition, that it wasn't running on a moderate agenda, but rather a conservative Republican agenda. And so I think the caucus that is taking up the vote today, I think we'll know more today about. But it seems that, you know, Tom has been, you know, pretty clear about, you know, his agenda involves business and education reform. This in a sense kind of fits into that a little bit. But I think there's a really important Senate. This is going to be a very important year over who controls the Senate. And so I think Eli is correct that the political calculation is absolutely part of this.
There's also a criticism developing, and I've levied it here on the show, of the Republican Senate, which is that it has done nothing. Its whole purpose at this point is to say no to proposals that are put forward by the governor and Democrats in the House and Democrats in the minority in the Senate. It's a kind of echo of what you hear going on at the national level. And so this allows the majority coalition or the Republican-controlled Senate, however you want to refer to it, to say, look, actually, we did come together and get something done.
And in the same context, you've got the head of the Ways and Means Committee, the Republican Andy Hill, putting out this idea that maybe, just maybe, the Senate doesn't have to put out a budget this year. You know, we're on a two-year budget cycle, and in odd number years, we pass a two-year budget, and then typically legislators come back in the even-numbered years, this being the even-numbered year, and pass a supplemental budget. And most years, I mean, every year that I can think of, going back way into the 80s and 70s, you know, when we started these annual sessions, there's been no doubt that the legislature is going to pass a supplemental budget. And this time around, what the Republicans are saying is, listen, this is a little different. Most years, we've had either a huge surplus that's been coming in, the budget has to be tweaked a little bit in the supplemental year. In recent years, through most of the Gregoire years, the forecast has been deteriorating every month, and the legislators have had to come back in the supplemental year and cut the budget. This year, the Republicans make the argument that, well, you know, the budget isn't that far out of whack for the first time in a long time, and maybe you can get away without passing a supplemental budget. Maybe you can just tweak things with a few bills, and you don't have to do a budget. So if they're taking positions on not passing a budget, if they're trying to push back on some of the school funding initiatives that the governor and the Supreme Court are pushing, going back to the Dream Act, this is something that demonstrates that they're getting something done, that they're willing to compromise.
Who benefits from arguing that we don't need a supplemental budget? I mean, is there a fiscal argument that the Republicans are going to be making?
Well, don't get me wrong. I think at the end of the day, there will be a budget. I think even a lot of Republican senators would tell you privately that they are going to do a budget. But I think the context is interesting. You have the state Supreme Court across the parking lot, which is trying to push the legislature to find more funding for schools this year. You have the governor, who originally proposed a hold steady budget, now coming around and saying, no, let's put another $200 million into school funding and teacher cost of living raises. And the Republicans have been pushing back on that. And I think the idea of floating this idea of not even doing a supplemental budget is more of a message to say to the court and to the governor that, wait, remember, this is a supplemental year. We've passed a two-year budget. It's not a year to make big policy changes. You can, but I think what their message is ultimately is to the court and to the governor, a shot across the bow to say, you know, it's not necessary.
Now, how would they pay for the Dream Act? I haven't heard that. The expansion of the Dream Act, which I think, if I'm reading right, is going to cost an additional $5 million.
They were talking about $5 million, right?
Yeah. I don't know. They haven't said. Maybe they have some – maybe that's where their effort to not have a supplemental budget might get confounded, huh?
Right.
Well, at some point, if you start passing a lot of bills to adjust spending and tweak spending, at what point do all those bills become a budget? Anyway, and so I think it's unrealistic that they won't pass a budget. I mean, the other calculus that goes into this is it's looking more and more unlikely that they're going to come to an agreement on a transportation package anytime soon. And imagine what the backlash might be if the legislature goes home after 60 days and there is no transportation package and there is no budget.
Yeah. Well, let's wrap in that transportation. Let's also wrap in Hobbs. But let me start by all that stuff by saying the Republicans were also pushing back, mostly Republicans in the Senate and the House as well, were pushing back on the Supreme Court for what did one representative say? Going over their lane, getting out of their lane for mandating specifics about spending and education. I mean, drawing a line at the sand, going over the lane, what's happening here? I mean, politically, what's happening?
Well, politically, what's happening is that the Supreme Court is insisting on, in a fairly detailed way, the way in which it expects the legislature to act to fulfill its constitutional duties. That's the Supreme Court's job. But the level of specificity is such that some Republicans have pushed back, as you say, by saying they're stepping into the legislative, you know, it's an activist court, it's a liberal activist court, they're stepping into our turf. The problem is that, in terms of the supplemental budget, Jay Inslee proposed, you know, what, about $200 million in additional education spending, a big chunk of that going toward a modest bump in cost of living raises for teachers. he came up with a way of paying for that by closing a bunch of tax loopholes and tax breaks. And but the bigger issue of the billions of dollars that the state has to come up with to fund that hasn't been resolved, won't be resolved certainly this session. But there's a nervousness, I think, about and this, I think, maybe goes to let's not do a budget. There's a nervousness to opening up the issue in the supplemental budget. If you put cost of living increases in now, does that mean you got to put them in later? Does it, you know, what does it do to the budgets, you know, as you go out? But the Republicans want basic reforms to occur in the educational system that have to do with merit increases and charter schools and, you know, various things like that before they solve them. And they want to be able to try and solve the education spending issue without raising taxes, which is pretty mind-bogglingly difficult to imagine how that would happen. But that's the position they've staked out. And as we pointed out before, this is more or less the kind of Rob McKenna position, which is fulfill the state's constitutional duties by putting all the money into education first. And if that leaves you less for everything else, well, then so be it.
Andy Hill, the budget writer, as you mentioned, he said it's tougher to go in and try to rejigger the budget on the level the governor wants. So dead in the water, governor's proposal, dead in the water?
Well, he proposed $200 million.
So many metaphors.
He proposed I thought we were getting away from the Seahawks metaphors. Yeah. But he proposed $200 million, and he proposed closing 7 tax exemptions to pay for that. And the tax exemptions, really, the ideas are nothing new. They've been floated around Olympia for a long time, and they range from closing, you know, a tax exemption on, you know, cars that you trade in over $10,000, to fuel taxes, to bottled water. I mean, they're familiar topics, and the problem with that, of course, is that all of these tax exemptions have staunch defenders and constituencies. And I'm reminded of Governor Gregoire in her last year or two in office. There was a tremendous call from unions, the SEIU and so forth, to close these tax exemptions instead of making cuts to social services. And remember, Governor Gregoire was extremely firm. She came out and she said, This is not low-hanging fruit. The low-hanging fruit has been taken. These are not tax exemptions that can be closed easily. We've tried it. We've gone down that road. They don't exist. There's not a political will or an ability to close these exemptions. And she was at odds with candidate Jay Inslee at the time in saying that. And so here we are with these tax exemptions coming back. And the reality of it is they're very difficult to close, these things. If you go through every one of them, they sound as if they should be easy to close. You know, closing the sales tax exemption for non-residents might sound like these are people who don't vote, but there's a constituency. There are retailers, there are merchants along the Oregon border who will speak very loudly. Each of these has staunch defenders.
And lobbyists.
Bottled water, janitorial services. You know, I'm struck by an article that you had written about the giving Boeing the tax breaks that it had makes a lot of things more difficult. It must also make the argument about getting rid of other tax breaks much more difficult as well, don't you think?
Yeah, you have a collision of two different things going on. One is that by extending the nearly $9 billion of tax breaks for Boeing, you have a lot of people who, both involved with that or peripheral to that, wanting some of those tax breaks, mostly B&O tax breaks, extended to other businesses within aerospace, the aerospace sector, but also elsewhere. I mean, people are saying, hey, where's my Boeing deal? So there's a moral sort of slippery slope there, but there's also and there's a case to be made for – I mean, one of the arguments that Inslee's aerospace advisors say is that, well, by giving tax breaks to sustainable energy companies or by expanding the tax breaks within the aerospace field, we become less Boeing dependent over time because you boost these other parts of the industry. So in the long term, they're actually good. So that's one of the arguments. But on the other side, that money is real money. That's $9 billion that's not going to go to education. That's $9 billion that's not going to go to the social safety net. It's not going to go to other functions. So you're creating a system where you're eating up revenue without replacing it, without finding a more progressive tax system, either income tax or other more progressive means of raising revenues at the same time. And so it's sort of created a I think it makes it very difficult. And one of the things I was looking at was I went through the document that the state prepared to make its pitch for Boeing doing the 777X assembly here. And in that, they crow about the fact that Washington doesn't have an income tax. I mean, they essentially are write that into the proposal as one of our selling points. Well, that's going to make income tax reform really difficult in the out years because it's undermining a deal you just made.
And so if you can't close tax loopholes and you can't create an income tax and you can't create really any new taxes, and the Supreme Court has told you that you need billions more to fund education as a constitutional obligation, there's no way getting out of it. Otherwise, we're going to have legislators held in contempt. What do you do? Well, you end up looking to cut social services, which, to go back to Gregoire's statement, she may have said that there are no tax loopholes that are easy to cut, but she also said we have cut social services to the bone. There is no more cuts to be made there. And so, and Jay Inslee has made the point, you know, we're trying to improve education. If we're sending hungry kids to school or kids who are suffering otherwise from elimination of social services, that's just shooting ourselves in the foot.
The there are some things that are being proposed on tax reform, and one of them is this issue of exemptions and subsidies and whatnot. And one is Reuven Carlisle, who's the representative of 36th District in Seattle, has a bill which is to – the gist of it is to end tax secrecy. One of the problems is that the public cannot know the extent to which these companies are getting advantage of these big tax breaks. So, for example, there's a tax break for oil refineries in the state, and Carlisle points out, you know, that amounts to X, you know, tens of millions of dollars a year, I think $60 million a year or something on that order. But we don't know how much Shell Oil is or British Petroleum are taking advantage of that. And the information is selectively released to legislators who, under threat of jail, cannot reveal that information to the public. And what he's saying is, unless you know how those things are actually, unless you can actually get from the Department of Revenue information on how those tax breaks are actually being used and who they're benefiting and how much, it makes it very difficult to propose eliminating tax breaks or seeing where the money is actually going. So he's has a House bill that would daylight some of this information.
And so the lawmakers have to sign this agreement that they won't disclose it, I think. And the question becomes then, some of these, if you're talking about tax exemptions, the argument from the businesses would be, well, that's proprietary information, right.
Exactly.
And we don't want that out there.
Any support for Carlisle's bill in the legislature at all, can it?
I'm not sure. I can't imagine that it would, go off like a prairie fire because I don't think those companies want to be able to reveal that information. I think it really is pointing out an issue. I hope it gets support. We'll see.
It's just that that's how Rob McKenna and the Republicans have run talking about sunlighting things. And I was just curious. Knute Burgess here. So is Robert Mack. So is Eli Sanders. Real quick before the break, you mentioned that majority coalition removing Steve Hobbs from his position of leadership. What's the politics there? I mean, is the majority a moderate majority coalition in name only?
Well, I'll set that up for Knute, but I'll say that the context of it is that last year the majority coalition had a majority of 25 to 24 with two Democrats on board, and then Jan Angel won a seat in Gig Harbor over Nathan Schlicker. And so this year, the majority coalition has a margin of 26 to 23. And there would be some who argue that they've seen a difference in the way the coalition is governing this year. I think in the there has been a lot of angst over what happened on the part of Democrats with Hobbs this week. And I guess my remaining question on it is what the Republicans say that they simply have a new member and that she's entitled to have a chairmanship. I guess the question that remains is why now? I mean, if they had done this prior to the session starting, I think it actually would have made very relatively little news. I think it's the timing that that caught people off guard.
Just looks partisan.
Yeah, I think it's hard to say that it's not partisan at some level. The Republicans are so. Steve Hobbs was the sole chair of the banking institution or the financial institutions committee. He's now been demoted to co-chair with Jan Angel and a new senator who's going to be up for re-election this year. And the issue that Hobbs raised, I thought, was really interesting. He basically said, look, I'm a Democrat. He was a member of the so-called Roadkill Caucus. I'm a Democrat who's defied my party and taken centrist votes. The majority coalition Republicans are not willing to do the same thing. We're not governing to the center. He's getting support quietly by people from suburban Republican moderates or some of the Democrats saying, gee, I really don't like the idea that you're getting dumped, you know, to co-chair on this committee, but we're voting along with the majority. We're not going to, on procedural stuff and in-house stuff, we're not going to deviate. And Hobbs is furious. He feels like if there would be bills that would be passed if everybody was truly voting, allowed to vote their conscience, from the center. And he's just saying the Republicans are not reciprocating, and therefore this is really disingenuous.
And yeah, we were discussing earlier that the Republicans make a very sound argument that the numbers have changed, and what's wrong with, giving Jan Angel an opportunity to co-chair a committee. And going back full circle to the DREAM Act, they can point to the DREAM Act and say, no, there is compromise and there is a center, and that they are willing to move there.
Sounds like a very fun session.
Yeah, as always.
All right.
You could understand why some of them are saying, maybe we'll just do nothing.
Yeah.
Skate on out of here.
For the election year. Robert Mack is a reporter, political analyst, former host of Upfront on King TV. He's the principal at SeattleTopStory.com. You should check it out. Knute Berger is the Mossback at CrossCut.com. Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. I want to ask you about the president and what the president had to say about such things. We edited the State of the Union to perhaps reveal a little bit of the theme that he had going into it.
Every mayor, governor, state legislator in America, I say, you don't have to wait for Congress to act, but I'll act on my own. I can take steps without legislation to expand opportunity for more American families. That's what I'm going to do.
The president showing that, he can have executive power. Is he showing that he's impotent in 2014 or that he still wields a big bully pulpit and a stick?
Well, I think
from the bully pulpit,
he's trying to show the latter. And there are a lot of things that he can do as president in terms of executive orders. Congress is, I don't think it could get any more unpopular. And this is also a way of raising up pressure on them to do something. And actually, you saw them come forward and say, not dissimilar from the state legislature conversation we were having, come forward and say today or yesterday, we're willing to compromise on immigration.
Yeah, that was interesting, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. I guess must be the talking points that people are receiving on that side. I wonder what the Democratic talking points will be to respond to that over time.
Yeah, I think I saw that Obama was receptive to it actually today, or thought it was a decent idea. But, seems a sign that they're feeling some pressure to not just be the no Congress, to actually get something done. there's another really interesting visual during the State of the Union where, you know, all these ideas that Obama put forward that are very popular and the Republicans just sitting on their hands over and over. That'll work for a while, but I think they've run out of room for that strategy.
You agree with that part, Robert Mack, that they don't want to be seen as the no Congress for this 2014 election?
Yeah, I think what's interesting is you have President Obama pledging to take action through executive power, and I think it goes to that fundamental question of what happens when a legislative branch is deadlocked. You know, on the federal level, you have President Obama, you know, pledging to do something on his own. At the state level in Washington state, we're seeing the same thing where the judicial branch is putting pressure on the legislature to fully fund education. And I think what we're witnessing is, you know, could be, you know, a historically significant struggle about what happens when the legislative branch is deadlocked, when it's perceived by the public as being ineffective, and the other branches of government stepping in to fill that vacuum.
But what we're seeing at the state level, anyways, is a pushback on the Supreme Court mm-hmm. for overstepping their bounds, and a pushback against Governor Inslee being unrealistic. I mean, it seems like the legislature. Cast back with me and take a 10,000-foot view. I mean, it seems like the legislature and the Congress really are revealing how much power they have through their ability to just stop.
The power of the purse is a huge, huge power. It's a very strong power, and they can slow things down incredibly, a legislative body, if they're just declining to act.
I mean, for instance, the president's pledge to install a minimum wage, at least for federal contracts, you're talking maybe about several hundred thousand workers. But there's a limit as to how much he can do with executive powers. And the same thing, you know, with Governor Inslee putting out a proposal to spend more on education. There's really a limit as to he can put it out there. But if it's not going anywhere, there's a limit as to what's going to happen without the legislature acting.
Yeah, I mean. If you could run by executive fiat, he would have been doing it. I mean, the changes you can make are significant, but they're more or less at the margins. The things that you actually have control over, because Congress is in charge of the money and they're in charge of the laws, passing the laws. So, you know, you can only do so much, and I think. You know, what you're seeing is this sort of setup for the fall elections in November in terms of, you know, Congress is going to want you can see that particularly the Republican House is trying to shed generally the sort of the saboteur element of their approach. In other words, when it comes to approving, you know, getting a budget deal, when it comes to shutting down government, they seem to have learned a lesson there, which is, you know, your popularity will plummet if you're seen as actively sticking, a stick in the spokes. But that doesn't mean you actually have to do anything, you know, substantive or activist. You know, and I think Obama has suddenly discovered income inequality as a potential fuel for the Senate and congressional campaigns coming up. And I think that you're going to see more focused on that. And that's kind of where Seattle has pioneered some of that in terms of Sawant raising those issues locally here and the minimum wage. Raising the minimum wage again and getting some fire built under that. And I think that is the kind of issue that's going to activate the kind of voters that need to turn out in an off-year election to give the Democrats any hope of keeping the Senate.
And there you see the power of these executive actions, even though they're limited in monetary scope, maybe. They call the question. They raise the profile of the debate over the particular issue. They force Congress to explain why it's not following the president further on raising the minimum wage. And they, as Knut is saying, they give Democratic candidates something to talk about.
I'm going to circle back to that, but let's go ahead. I was just going to raise Sawant's issue, Rose
well,
her.
Before we get to that, one other State of the Union thing I just wanted to go off on was Kathy McMorris Rogers. She's the highest ranking woman in the U.S. House. She's a representative from Washington State. She gave a response to the thing. And, you know, to me, it, you know, she really embodies this loony disconnect between what the people who are very reliant on federal spending, decrying federal spending and decrying and
you're speaking about her district in Spokane.
Yeah. And we talked a little bit about this before, but I thought this was really interesting. So she, you know, she is, you know, wants to cut federal spending, is criticized. She was supportive of the government shutdown. She's one of the people in the wing of the Republican Party. I mean, she's cast as sort of a moderate, but not really. I mean, by any definition, she's a far right conservative. And so I was looking. She comes from Northeast Washington, Stevens County, Kettle Falls. She's from up in that area. And if you think about that area, Tim Egan had a column about how the areas that she represents are some of the hardest hit economically and need, you know, they're the areas that need the kind of government support and intervention they've been. And they have, you know, they rely on public utility districts. They rely on cheap power from Bonneville. They have, and there's the three counties up in northeastern Washington have an economic development arm, and they're trying to get the economy going up there and figuring out. And so I was reading it. So we're talking about Ponderay Ferry, Stevens County, right in the, you know, heart of her district. And I was looking through this elaborate plan that they've adopted for the next year. And what was the number one threat, they said, to their being able to climb out of the economic hole they're in? The number one threat was stagnant or declining federal and state funding for infrastructure projects. You know, I just find it completely fascinating that somebody who represents that area in Congress is telling the rest of the country to, you know, that the government, we don't need it, shut down, spending too much. And yet in our own district, you know, people are begging for the kinds of basic infrastructure, roads, broadband, you know, business development programs, all kinds of federal programs and state programs. And anyway, I just the hypocrisy of that just drives me nuts.
That's what I was going to say. You'd use the word fascinating, and I was going to say fascinating is one word. Hypocrisy is another one. And I really recommend, like Knut, this Tim Egan column that came out today about the hypocrisy of Kathy McMorris Rodgers and the disconnect, total disconnect between what she was putting forward in her response and what actually goes on in her county. Another point that that Tim Egan made is the incredible number of people who are signing up for health care reform or for health insurance under the health care reform law in McMorris Rodgers's district and how much they need it and how strongly she opposed health care reform.
And yet if you look at that speech, though, she gave a composed speech. In some ways, you look at a speech such as that as being successful if you avoid that awkward moment of drinking water, for example, that Marco Rubio went through. And in the speech, though, she did articulate, and if you listen to it, she did articulate what is this huge philosophical difference that leads to this deadlock in Congress, which is she turned this discussion about income inequality and said we should be more focused on equality of opportunity. And that is, in there lies that fundamental difference between the political parties that you see at the federal level and, frankly, in our debate in the state and the city level, the local level, the debate over minimum wage comes down to that. It's this question of the role of government and how you focus on those issues. Everyone agrees that there are certain problems, but the fundamental philosophical differences are so stark that we end up with this deadlock.
Yeah. Well, I just have to say, if it weren't for the federal government, her district would be a wasteland, literally. You
know? Right.
It would be desert, dry, nothing.
There would be well, that's not what they're arguing, though, right? They're arguing something entirely different. If it weren't for the federal government, there'd be more opportunities for people to
the counter argument is in places like Ferry County and whatnot is the federal government needs to eliminate regulations so we can log and mine more, you know. So, I mean, that's part of
right.
So there is a lot of resource economy. Those basic kind of issues are still alive up there. But it's based on the fact that there is no appreciation or little appreciation or memory for what got them from where they were to where they are. And there is a consciousness about the fact among the economic development people up there is they need more additional help, not less.
Right. And so when Kathy McMorris Rogers articulated this philosophy, which in the end applied to her own district, doesn't make any sense, she also repeated a number of times, we have plans, we have plans. And so it's one thing to articulate a broad philosophy or really to just like put out some platitudes that we've heard before, but she didn't articulate any plan. There is no plan that she's put forward that will answer the question that Knut has posed. How is her district going to thrive without help from the federal government when it is so dependent on the federal government right now and when the federal government created a lot of the opportunity that her district has in the first place?
Well, let me go back. If I could, Ken, let me go back to this whole philosophical debate, though, about how you approach these issues and what the role of government is. This, you know, at the state level, we had this big discussion this week about the minimum wage. You know, you've got cities like SeaTac and Seattle trying to pave their own way, headed toward $15. And at the same time, you have legislation from the Republicans in the Senate that got a hearing this week. One bill would prohibit cities from going it alone, from getting away from a minimum wage that the state sets. Another bill would actually lower the minimum wage for folks under 19. And create something that's perhaps 85% of the minimum wage for teenagers. And what's interesting about that is what the argument from the Republicans is that you have high teenage unemployment, and they believe one of the reasons is that you've got a minimum wage. So you've got an employer who is thinking about hiring a young person. And frankly, young people do take more supervision, more training. And if it's between hiring a young person at a minimum wage and hiring someone who's perhaps older, they may go for the older person because there is the net is that they're going to spend more time hiring and training this younger person. So you have a training wage. It encourages teen employment, and you drive down this problem that teenagers can't find jobs. Meanwhile, you've got the Democrats who say, well, that's not the reason that we have a high teenage unemployment. The reason we have high teenage unemployment is because we're coming out of this recession and that a lot of adults have stayed in the workforce, that people haven't retired, and that this is the situation of our economy, and lowering the minimum wage is not the answer. There's the issue. What's the government's role? What can government dictate? What kind of regulation should there be? And if you leave the market to its own forces, will you be better off? It's the same argument we've had for decades.
Except I would just add that the normal positions are a little bit turned on their head here, because you normally have Republicans arguing that local jurisdictions should be able to do whatever they want. And here you have Republicans arguing that the state is going to tell them what they can and can't do in terms of setting wages.
Shama Sawant, the new city council member, giving back two-thirds of her salary, her city council salary. What is this? Is this a challenge to her fellow council members? Is this a stunt? How do you interpret this, Eli?
It's a keeping of a campaign promise, and it's a keeping of faith with her supporters. I think she said repeatedly that she wanted to not only represent voices that are not normally represented, but stay of those voices, stay a part of those voices. And so she is suggesting that it is hard to do that when you're taking home over $100,000 a year, which is what all the other council members are doing. I don't see it so much as a challenge to them, although it does, implicitly raise one. But I really just think it's a way for her to avoid a trap of criticisms of hypocrisy, and for her to just keep faith with her campaign and her promises. And it's quite remarkable. I mean, she is now going to take home,
40,
after taxes, $40,000. Now, she'll have a lot of good benefits and so on, health insurance for being on the council. But that's a very dramatic gesture, and it really serves to remind what people are working with in King County. She's at $40,000 because she's saying that's about the average take-home pay for someone in this county. So it's a great way to constantly remind people how the majority is living.
What did you make of it, Skip? Knut?
Well, I thought the same thing. I mean, she made a commitment. She's making, I think, a political and a personal moral statement. It's consistent with her philosophy. you know, as she's going to be donating the money to causes that she believes in and wants to further politically, and she's still going to have to pay taxes on the money as if she's earning it. You know, I think it's fine. It's a principled stand. I think I she's not demanding that other people follow her example. I think what people get paid in their economic circumstances, you know, it's their business. Other people have raised the issue. I was reading an item, I think, in the Times today about some activists who are challenging Sally Bagshaw and Bruce Harrell to cut their salaries, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's a way in which you can, but I think this is more less about the. It's personal in the sense that it's her personal choice to do this. But I think when you get into other people's things, it's if that, I mean, that salary is what the salary of the job is. Everybody knows it going in. I think the people collecting it should be entirely guiltless in collecting that kind of salary.
What do you think? Same thing?
I do think it's consistent. I think that's one word that everyone's used. You know, I think moving forward, the really interesting thing about Sawant is she has been very consistent from the campaign to her first days on the city council. And what will be interesting to see is how she evolves over the next few years, because as we know, most issues that the city faces are not black and white. There's a tremendous amount of gray area and tremendous different shades of gray. And the question is, how does a new politician navigate those shades of gray to be pure, to be truthful, to be faithful to what you campaigned on and to your supporters, and yet to navigate all those shades of gray when the issues come up? It's going to be really interesting.
It will be. And one facet of this may be that she sees that coming. And that she will inevitably, working in a legislative body, have to make some compromises. That's the nature of the beast. And if she can lay down this marker of consistency and purity, you know, in the eyes of her supporters, it will be a good touchstone to come back to. I had to move a little bit on this, but I am so committed to my principles that I continue to only take this amount of salary to keep faith with the people who I came here to represent.
Okay. I can't believe I went 50 minutes and didn't even bring up the biggest story of this whole week. You know, Mayor Ed Murray of Seattle and Mayor Michael Hancock of Denver were on the Colbert Report last night, and they were sounding stoked for this Super Bowl battle.
Well, Stephen, in the very unlikely event that Seattle would beat the Denver Broncos, I'm going to offer to Mayor Murray some Colorado beef steak.
Well, in the impossible event that Seattle were to lose, I'm going to offer to Mayor Hancock some incredible salmon from the Northwest.
All right, all right.
These guys are really thrilled. Didn't they just sound pumped? And they just sound like they are ready to go for the superb owl, as Stephen Colbert calls it. Why do they call it? Why is he calling it the superb owl?
Well, they're... are people who follow some. There's a subculture of people who follow sports and bird teams, for example, the Cardinals, the Seahawks, the Falcons, the Eagles fall into the and the bird. The people who follow the bird teams, and they get very excited when bird teams face each other. And they all have called the Super Bowl the superb owl,
which is also obviously what you get when you slide the B over. From
yeah,
bowl.
Yeah, I get that part. Yeah. Okay. I thought it was also some contractual thing. That yeah, said superb owl instead of Super Bowl. He didn't have to pay something.
This is not a superb owl. Superb owl. This is a because I think it's bird versus ungulate. I think there in the Broncos. So somebody can correct me if I'm wrong about what an ungulate is. But
I think you're good on that. So Ken Jennings wrote this column. I've been hearing it all week. Fans in Seattle can't embrace the notion that we're winners and that we're going to win because we have a winner's mentality, a.k.a. a la Richard Sherman. I mean, I'm a Cubs fan. I think I know what it's like to support a not winning team. But do you feel that way walking around? Like, oh, people are really – they've still got – they got the rain cloud over their heads. They're just not going to really do it.
I think my sense – and you're talking to someone who's a very fair weather – football fan here, but my sense is that no, people have a hope that has not existed before when it comes to sports teams here in general and then the football team in particular. But I think there is some truth to the tempering of it, because having never won a Super Bowl, it's hard to believe that it would actually happen.
Luke Burbank is host of LiveWire. He's also host of the podcast Too Beautiful to Live. Shows up on the NPR program Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Are you one of those fans, Luke? Are you just not embracing it?
By the way, Ed Murray just living up to his nickname of Charisma Black Hole that I have given him.
He's going to give really you some salmon, Luke.
By the way, what is the vig on those bets between mayors if it doesn't get paid off? It's like if you have a bet with like the Georgia mayor and it's a basket of peaches, is it like two peaches a week? Every week they don't pay it back. I mean, does somebody show up to break their kneecaps?
We're going to be giving them boatloads of salmon if we don't start paying it off. We'll be trucking them the other way.
That's right. We'll have a new agreement that we don't like to go along with the ones that we have with the tribes.
Yeah.
It'll be the agreement we have with the city of Denver. I actually am one of those people who feels, as Eli was saying, a weird hope and sort of, I don't know, confidence that is not natural to a native Seattle sports fan. Really and truly, like I actually think, not to get too about the X's and O's, but I actually think we match up really well with Denver in terms of the things we're good at are things that will really help us in stopping them, I think. And there was something so cathartic about winning that game against San Francisco at home, which was like the moment when it seems like a Seattle sports team will typically kind of pick the wrong, you know, there's a fork in the road, and the Seattle sports team, it's like Charlie Brown trying to kick the football. But the way that Richard Sherman knocked that pass away, it was like Charlie Brown made contact with the football somehow, and it's like some sort of, I don't know, psychic sort of curse is broken. So I think we're going to win on Sunday, and I don't think it's going to be that close is my gut feeling.
But are you embracing that notion, or are you afraid of it?
No, I'm not. I'm not afraid of it at all. I do think that Richard Sherman has brought some swagger, and I thought that it was really interesting. I think we talked about this last week, but the story has evolved even further of the way that Richard Sherman went from being kind of public enemy number one after the postgame interview to Mr. Thoughtful Football Talker guy after he talked about the word thug and everything, and he's sort of been the darling of the media week this week. And so I don't know. I feel like it's an example to Seattleites that you can be brash. And you know, you can still, people will still respect you. And in fact, I mean, I think that we probably should take a note from Richard Sherman as a city.
Skip, you've been going to Seahawks games. You got that Seahawks scarf around your neck every week, I've seen the last few weeks. Are you swaggering?
Am I swaggering? No, I'm not swaggering. I'm excited, though. You know.
But you're still kind of, the moss is still the most.
I wanted to see a moss too much when he swaggers.
And I think anybody who, you know, I've been following the Seahawks, you know, since the 70s, and, you know, we deserve to be deliriously happy. Because it just, these things don't happen very often, and you got to embrace. And, you know, the idea, I think they're going to win. I want them to win. If they don't win, you know, my identity personally and my civic identity is not wrapped up in winning the Super Bowl. It's just like a big, great cherry on top of, you know, the experience. And I, you know, you look back to 1995 where the Mariners made that great playoff run. That was an incredible, I mean, the city was kind of going through a similar experience. And the fact that they didn't go to the World Series was disappointing, but it doesn't take anything away from what it was like.
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out.
I have to say, I had this really interesting discussion with my 4-year-old son, who was wearing his Russell Wilson jersey, and he was confused a little bit about this whole concept of the 12th man. And if you think about it from a 4-year-old's perspective, who is this number 12 that it says FAN on the back of the shirt? And I was trying to explain to him this intangible, this 12th man, this the people in the stadium, this community. And, you know, it is that intangible value of community spirit that, you know, professional sports teams and politicians always point to when they're asking public contributions to fund stadiums, for example. And, you know, with everyone caught up with this 12th man, it's the groups like Citizens for More Important Things who would point out that, you know, you have paid some taxes to this moment, that you have contributed in the form of admissions taxes or parking taxes or rental car taxes or, you know, whatever the taxes may be. And, you know, for some people, there's still a resentment about contributing to national football and the multimillion-dollar salaries. And yet for so many others, it's worth every penny.
Luke, you got
Plus that shirt Luke had to buy.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I'm still rocking that shirt. I'll be wearing it on Sunday. By the way, have they changed the name yet to Citizens for More? Nobody wants to hear you right now.
That's right. I was going to ask if you had any last words, but I guess that's it. You're going to be down there at the port.
Exactly.
Marching back and forth.
I'll be the guy wandering around in the uncomfortable, lucky Seahawks sweater that I bought on eBay from the 1980s. One more game. I just want to wring one more lucky game out of it.
All right. And when it's over, Pete Carroll, now the most popular coach, is going to push the NFL to allow medical marijuana.
Although, let me just throw this factoid in, because it will be interesting to public radio listeners. The Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me people tell me he is the second worst guest they've ever had on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Topped by...
Russell Simmons. True story. I'm letting you behind the curtain, people.
Thank you very much. We'll see you behind the curtain again on the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And tonight on LiveWire at 8 o'clock on KUOW. That's Luke's variety show. Also on the podcast, TBTL. Robert Mack, Seattle Top Story. Eli Sanders in The Stranger. Knut Berger at crosscut.com. Thank you all. And I just end. Go Hawks.